How's the sequel going?
Sequel sucks.
Bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
I'll be back.
Why won't you die?
Prime, you can't die.
Then reboot, damn it.
Reboot complete.
Thank you very much.
Movies.
Never say die.
Welcome to Movies Never Say Die, a podcast with a singular focus, movies that are reboots, reimaginings, or sequels to other films. I'm Matthew Grant.
And I'm Justin St. Ange. This is episode number 2 for us. So we're keeping it going. Today's episode, sponsored by The Legend of Stan Lee. As you all know, we lost a great pop culture influencer this past week.
Massive, huge loss to the creative community. I mean, he's the father / godfather / grandfather of many popular characters in comics and now obviously movies. And he showed up in a lot of the movies and cameos, which I believe, did they say that he's actually filmed cameos for upcoming Marvel movies? Is that the general consensus?
According to what I've read, he has recorded for Captain Marvel and for Avengers, but that's it.
Well, I mean, it'll be cool to see him again. It's just certainly a huge loss, and seemed like a good guy. Seemed like he loved his fans a great deal right up to the end, and so it's
It'll be interesting. It kind of sucks that he couldn't record anything for the next Spider-Man, since that was like his biggest influence on pop culture in general, and I think his favorite, the one he was most proud of.
Yeah, it seemed like that. I mean, it's a shame. I mean, if I were Marvel, I would have just been recording cameos, just one-sided cameos that just had his face for just dozens of movies, and just used them, just found a way to put him in or something.
Well, I guess he had to film around his age and his health.
Are we concerned about a human being's age and health? How dare you, sir?
Oh, sorry. I mean, he was a young 95.
Oh yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm glad he got to do as much as he did, and just we could have like an entire series of podcasts on what he's contributed to comic books and just the creative world in general. So it's definitely a huge loss to the creative community.
Yeah, I think you saw I tweeted when he passed away that one of my prized possessions is a comic book that I got him to sign when he came around. Not like a big comic con, but like a little convention that near where I lived. It was really cool.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. What where was it? What did you have him sign?
It was in Fairfax near where I live, but it was not a big comic by any stretch of the imagination. So around that time, early 90s, the Marvel started this 2099 run of comic books like Spider-Man 2099 and stuff like that, and much Hulk and much bigger names. This was actually a brand new comic that he came up with. It was called Ravage 2099.
Oh, okay.
And he signed the cover there for lots of people, but that's the one I got him to sign.
Oh, that's cool.
It didn't last very long. That lasted like 8 issues, and then they canceled it. But in my mind, it's still so awesome that might even make it worth more to me. Not monetarily, but worth more to me.
Oh yeah, just because it's something a little more rare. That's not just some random Spider-Man comic that anybody would have. But it's something a little more personal, a little more interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. It's got its place in my comic book collection.
Nice, very cool.
On this episode of Movies Never Say Die, we're going to take a look at Ant-Man and the Wasp, along with its predecessor, Ant-Man. But first, here's a look at some official announcements, rumors, and hearsay for upcoming reboots in our opening segment, In the Pipeline.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon.
Pipeline.
Hey, we got a couple of sequels that have pretty much locked in. Avatar sequels, you've told me this, I didn't realize, have finished principal photography.
Yeah, I was surprised. I saw a thing that James Cameron said. He, I mean, not just like he finished principal photography on Avatar 2. Like, he's claiming they finished principal photography in Avatar 2 through 5, which, I mean, you know, we could probably talk about Avatar in every single pipeline segment because he's been talking about it for years and there's going to be supposedly five of them. But Sigourney Weaver said the same thing. She said she just finished shooting a whole bunch of stuff, said she was involved in a lot of underwater work, which means obviously there's a little bit of a change of scenery for the characters in Avatar. And so it's, I mean, supposedly principal photography is locked.
And also Godzilla King of the Monsters, the recent tweet from the director said that he's it's locked in, fully finalized.
Yeah, that's it. I think his tweet showed a picture of the title card for the movie, Legendary Legendary Pictures logo, and I guess that's it. They're done. I don't know if we talked about this. They have a release date on that.
I have not looked that up. Actually, I'm not sure entirely.
May 31st, 2019. Look at that. It's an early. Wow.
Yeah, there's a great. I don't know if it's in that teaser tweeted or not. The shot of Godzilla like looking up into the sky, like shooting his cosmic beam.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep, I saw that. I don't think it was in the tweet, but it's I think it was from Entertainment Weekly. There was that great shot of the him shooting the fire in the sky, and it's all kind of blue and aqua.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Very cool. Did you see? You saw the first Godzilla, but the most recent Godzilla reboot?
Yeah, no, I saw it. And I actually saw it. It's one of the very rare films I saw in 3D IMAX because a friend of mine loves to do big event movies in 3D IMAX, and so we had to see like Pacific Rim and all that sort of thing. He loves seeing it in the $25 massive theaters, and so. But it was, I mean, it was good. It was, I thought that was very well done. I thought I was, you know, spoiler alert, shocked that Brian Cranston kicked off as early as he did. And I thought it looked fantastic. I love the plot of it, and I like what they did with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, that picture just reminds me of the, you know, near the climax of that where he. He opens up the mouth of that other monster and just blows him to smithereens.
That's right. I forgot about that. It was pretty cool. And then, and you saw Skull Island. So the kind of the way they're going to tie King Kong and Godzilla together. I've not seen the Kong. I don't know, remake.
Yeah, I did see that. That was pretty fun, and I enjoyed that as well. I think I like Godzilla a little bit more, but this was good too. Starting to Marvel MCU actors, Loki and Captain Marvel, actually. Hiddleston and Brie Larson are in that movie.
Okay, cool. I have no clue. I'll have to check it out one of these days. It's on the list.
Very long list of movies to see.
Never enough time.
All right, and moving on to movies that are coming up real soon, we got Ralph Breaks the Internet. That's opening up this coming week in 2 or 3 days.
Yep.
It's actually pretty good. I don't always go for these animated ones, but I enjoyed it very much. It takes a very good look at the whole video game, inside the video game world.
It's interesting because I've got kids and they loved watching Wreck-It Ralph, and there was so much in there for the kids to watch. But then, I mean, there's so much of it that's directed at, you know, people, you know, your age, my age, because, you know, we got that support group for all the different video game characters, and, you know, there's video game characters straight out of our youth and all the different video game worlds, even though they made up their own video games and video game worlds. It was based on a lot of stuff that, you know, you and I came up playing. And so they were very smart about the way they did that one. And this one seems to be very similar in that, you know, it looks like a fun movie for kids, but then at the same time, there's all these little self-referential things that, at least I can see from the trailers, that it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun for both kids and grown-ups. I thought it was definitely a movie that made sense.
Totally. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing it. One of the funny things I thought is when they announced the name to it, a lot of people felt that they missed the mark when they, because the first one is called Wreck-It Ralph, and perhaps they should have just called this one Ralph Wrecks the Internet.
I didn't even think about that.
But I guess Breaks the Internet is a, you know, common term.
I guess.
Also coming up in December, Bumblebee. You and I have talked about this a couple times since they announced it and all the posters and the trailers. How when they first announced it, you know, yep. I think we both felt the same way. Why? We've had how many? Like 6 Transformers now? And, yep, exactly. Each one progressively, actually almost exponentially worse than the previous one.
they got pretty hard to watch. I know I didn't see the last one. There's a possibility I didn't see the one before that, but I just lost track of that. It was just so painful.
But the reason that they make, the last one, I forget what it's called, The Last Night, didn't make, the almost 2 billion that the previous ones have made. But people still go to watch it because, this is your childhood and, you want to see the story end. So I did watch it. I wasn't impressed, of course, but I just need to know. I need to know what happens.
I get
you. With the trailer to Bumblebee and some of the stuff that they've been coming out with, I'm actually pretty excited about it. We talked about in the first full length trailer when they showed the Gen 1 Transformers.
Yeah, that I was not expecting that even remotely. I mean, I knew that it was a an origin story and a prologue type thing to the current series of movies, but I did not even remotely expect that we'd suddenly see. But even if they just make cameos in this movie, because there's like a flashback or something, the fact that we saw old school Optimus Prime and all, I got very, it was basically everything I wanted to see many years ago when they did the original Michael Bay Transformers was suddenly on screen. And it was, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm very excited about this movie more than I probably should be, but I'm in the.
Because at first it seems like almost exactly the same story as the first Transformers with Shia LaBeouf, right? So they gender swapped him. Young person finds Bumblebee and then they go on their own adventure. But fingers crossed, but still excited. All right, a couple movies releasing in June, actually the same weekend, June 21st. Child's Play and Toy Story 4.
This is an interesting counter-programming move there, for sure.
You got the killer toy and then the toys you love. That would be great if Toy Story took a turn.
Yeah, this...
They just murder Andy. That'd
be amazing. That'd be Wait, what? Why is this one rated R? You abandoned us, Andy. Have you seen both of the teasers for that one? The new ones that just came out?
Are there two teasers? I thought there was the one. Did I miss something?
They've got the one where the group of them is kind of dancing around in the ring around the Rosie when the spoon gets introduced.
Yeah.
And then the second one has these two characters that are played apparently by Key and Peele. Have you seen that one yet or no?
I have not.
It was, I guess it's pretty new. It's like, Key and Peele are there talking, and then the other Toy Story characters kind of creep in and join them. And, it's the same sort of thing as the first one, where it's more of a tease. It's not like a specific, there's no scenes of the movie or anything, but it's just the two of them talking, and they're talking about, like, Buzz Lightyear, and they're trying to do impressions of Buzz Lightyear and Woody, and then Woody and Buzz Lightyear come in, and they're like, oh, no, this is how you do it, to infinity and beyond, or whatever. And so it's just... It's just kind of an introduction to the two characters, and it's like a minute and a half long scene, which just kind of gives you an idea of at least character wise what to expect from the two of them. But I mean, nothing's revealed plot wise or anything like that. Just very early teases, which I'm all for, since most ads or trailers give away far too much of the movie. But it was nice to see just a little bit of character work from these first two teasers.
Yeah. I think you feel the same way. A lot of quote-unquote teaser trailers keep getting released when it seems like it's a full-on trailer. Like some companies, the first trailer they release, they're calling it the teaser trailer, whereas these two definitely, I think, count more so as teasers.
Yeah, you even got like commercials for the teasers. Like, we got this 10-second ad that's like teaser tomorrow.
Oh, I can't stand that.
It drives me nuts.
It's like, like you said, it's like 3 seconds of the actual trailer before you're watching the trailer.
Well, it's tough too, because nowadays it's like, back in the olden times, you didn't know everything about a movie before it came out. And so when you're sitting in a movie theater, anything they played was a surprise. And so, teasers could actually be teasers. And, if they just, some of the teasers I remember, they would just put up the logo of the superhero and people would go crazy. Like, it was just, even when they first announced Batman versus Superman at Comic-Con, the announcement trailer was like, the bat symbol superimposed over the Superman symbol. People knew exactly what it meant and they went crazy. Right. But now it's like, you know everything about a potential. I mean, sometimes you've even seen the trailers before you even go to the theater. And so to have something like this where they actually have a little bit of fun with doing something it's not seen to the movie, they're made specifically for the trailer, I think that they've done a very good job, especially since they kind of neatly wrapped up the whole Toy Story story, so to speak, so well with part three that it just, I mean, it didn't seem like there was anywhere they can go, and it was such a beautiful ending for them to kind of cautiously, I mean, it's, I guess it's like a semi sequel slash reboot because they're, you know, even though it's the same characters, they're, you know, in a new house with a new kid supposedly. And, you know, it's, they're being very smart about how they're marketing it. Like I just saw the posters for these, and it's all it has is like one poster has a picture of Woody sneaking along a bookshelf and the year 2019 above him. And the other poster has Buzz Lightyear doing the same thing. And, you know, I think they're doing a very good job kind of slowly easing you into this movie. And, you know, it's not coming out till June of next year, and so they've got some time, but I think it's very cool the way they've done it so far.
Yeah, that's one of the tease posters I saw was, it's basically just, it's almost black and white. I can't remember if it's it's very muted, but it's like Woody, you know, tipping his hat but kind of facing away, like almost.
Oh, really? I don't see that one. That's cool.
Yeah, like not quite. It almost gives me, I doubt they would, you know, end Woody. But that almost, it gives me a feeling that something bad is in store for one of the characters.
Oh, yeah, I guess it does make sense, huh?
Especially if they, well, who knows, but especially if they are ending it with this fourth one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm curious to see whether or not they kind of start a new trilogy, or if they use this, like you said, as a way to kind of wrap it up a little more specifically than they did with part three.
Which was excellent. I mean, all first three ones, so definitely in good hands. But you know, how I really thought three, like you said, just really wrapped it up right quite nicely. So the new one will be interesting to see.
Definitely. And then the and Child's Play. It's interesting with the way they're doing Child's Play, because they've kind of had they had an interesting bit of success with them. Kind of, I guess not really. I don't even know if you'd call them reboots, because they're still technically sequels. But they really changed the whole mood and vibe of the Child's Play series, because the first three were straight up horror films. And then you get into like Bride of Chucky, Seed of Chucky, and it gets super campy. And, you know, he's cracking one liners and it's funny and it's weird and dark. And then they again kind of course corrected with the last two movies they came out with, or one or two, I think. I know they had The Curse of Chucky, and I can't remember if they had another one. But then they again kind of hooked left into doing straight up horror again, and then all of a sudden, kind of out of nowhere, you've got just a legit reboot that, you know, once again, like we talked about last episode, they're just calling it Child's Play. There's no subtitle, there's no sequel, or I mean, there's no number after, it's just Child's Play again. And same characters in the first one. You've got Andy Barkley, you got his mom, played by Aubrey Plaza,
who I love.
Who doesn't?
Fools, that's who. But so I mean, it's interesting. And then it doesn't seem like they're even using the same voice. Brad Dourif, who's done the voice since the original film and is carried on through all these various reboots and sequels and whatever you want to call them, doesn't seem to be involved. And so it'll be really interesting to see what they do with this, because the plot seems similar to the first one. You know, you have Andy's mom just gives him a toy, unaware that it's, you know, haunted or whatever. And the poster, again, we're talking about teasers. The poster they released recently, very, very simple stuff. It's just the toy box just sitting there in the middle of an old warehouse looking creepy, and it just has the name of the movie, and that's, you know, basically it.
Yeah, I saw the poster. I was wondering, it seems like that they changed the brand of the doll itself. Like in the originals, it was called Good Guy Dolls, and on the poster, I think the box of the toy said that they were called Buddy Dolls.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And I think also in the, you know, with the reboot, they're changing it from kind of, you know, the mystical voodoo spell to more of an AI aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I. I mean, I kind of understand that that's a more timely topic, but it's like, you know, it certainly changes a lot of the original, you know, intent or plot of the first one. So, I mean, you know, if they're looking to do something different, this is, you know, very obviously the way to do it, but it's certainly going to be interesting. I liked the original series of movies. I mean, the first one came out in 88, and so I've been watching them for, you know, 20 years, but
30.
Very, I guess that's right. My math is suspect.
You came late to it. You started watching in 98.
Absolutely. Of course. Thank you, sir. Well done. You
saved me. Yeah. I think I've only seen the first one. Obviously, it's an iconic franchise, but I don't think this ever really, really ever captured me.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big horror movie fan, and so I watched the first series of them, you know, 1, 2, and 3, and then once they started coming back again with the campier films later on, it was just, you know, it started off as kind of an idea of like sheer morbid curiosity, like what the hell are they going to do with this? And then, you know, I did end up liking them for what they were. I mean, Jennifer Tilly was hilarious, and it was just so weird, and then she was playing herself, but also playing the doll, and there's, I don't know, I mean, this, you know, again, this might be the only real way to do it, kind of like they did with Halloween, is just kind of retcon the other movies out of existence and do their own thing. But, you know, I've also heard rumors that it's a rights issue, like they couldn't get the rights to certain things and so, or certain elements of it, and so they kind of did their own thing. But it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, that could be it. I mean, you know, with all these franchises kind of not entirely starting over, like you said, sometimes just kind of following from the first original and then having a sequel, whatever, 30 years later and ignoring everything else, that so many hands have changed in the copyrights and all the stuff that they would have rights issues.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated after that, although, you know, because I think, yeah, I mean, the original creator's still around. I think he was involved in the last one they did, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with it for sure.
Then coming out in March 29th, I believe, and they just released a full trailer, Dumbo live action Disney again strikes.
I think it's Tim Burton directing it too, right?
Absolutely, and correct? I didn't even realize this, and I'm sure this will make you happy. Tim Burton directing, Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito are also in Dumbo.
Oh, you know, I feel like I knew Danny DeVito was in, but I did not know Michael Keaton was in it. That's fascinating. Yes. I am happy.
Batman Returns reunited.
That is very cool. I didn't even think about that. I think is that the first time they've worked together since then? That's crazy.
Maybe with Danny DeVito. I don't know.
Well, yeah, see, I know Danny DeVito did Big Fish with Tim Burton, but I think Michael Keaton hasn't done anything with him since then. That's pretty cool. And this should be interesting too, because, you know, again, it's a reimagining of a classic Disney movie, but I'm sure, much like Alice in Wonderland, it's obviously got to have that Tim Burton spin on. I mean, I haven't seen the full length trailer, but I saw the teaser for it, and it already looks, you know, to obviously be set within one of his worlds. And, you know, did you see the full,
I haven't seen the full length trailer, but I agree that, like you said, he's done Alice in Wonderland, but Tim Burton's, he doesn't always strike me as something that would mesh with Disney, but you never know.
How it does. I mean, it's very strange, but somehow he makes it
I mean,
work.
He's, you know, don't get me wrong, I love his work, but actually, I don't think I've seen any of these, his Disney ones, so.
I saw the first Alice in Wonderland, and I did not see the second one. The first one I thought, or wait, he might not have directed the second Alice in Wonderland. I think he actually didn't. I think like his maybe director of photography did the second one. But I saw the first one. I liked it a lot. I thought it was enjoyable. I mean, that was unfortunately kind of the beginning of the kind of backlash against Johnny Depp, because all of a sudden it's like Johnny Depp's just playing one weirdo character in every single thing that he does. And I think the second one was directed by somebody else. Somebody else entirely in the second one, the director or writer of the Ali G show. So it was just kind of weird, but you know, he still kept the same kind of visual aesthetics. I know the second movie, Alice Through the Looking Glass, focused more on Johnny Depp's character. And, you know, I think he went missing and Alice had to go find him or something. So it was definitely, I mean, I liked, like I said, I liked what he did with it. I mean, I liked what he did with the Willy Wonka movie. I really do enjoy the original Gene Wilder one, but this he brought just enough of his Tim Burton-ness to the new one that I really enjoyed watching it as kind of its own film. So I don't know, it should be interesting to see what he does with Dumbo.
Yeah, I think I've been stubbornly not watching the Willy Wonka sequels or the remakes because, like you, the first one is just so iconic with Gene Wilder. I haven't brought myself to watch the...
Oh, you haven't seen Charlie and the Chocolate Factory yet? Oh, it's not bad. I like it. You know, I mean, it's very strange. I thought they did way too much backstory because, sometimes, I mean, it's the same thing we talked about last episode with Rob Zombie's, one of the problems I had with Rob Zombie's Halloween was I didn't care about Michael Myers' backstory. I also don't care why Willy Wonka is Willy Wonka, but, Tim Burton had to, put Christopher Lee in there somewhere, and I guess he got to be his dad, so that's what I ended up with.
I think the last one I really want to get into here on Pipeline is Glass, the upcoming continuation of the Unbreakable Split movie series directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
And how exciting was that? I mean, that until the last 5 minutes of Split, we had no idea this was all in the same universe and that it was leading to this Battle Royale third film, which is, I think you and I talked earlier that I still haven't seen Split, but I specifically sought out the last 5 minutes just so I could see Bruce Willis show up as that character again, because I think Unbreakable is one of my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movies, one of his most underrated, although it's kind of become a cult favorite over the years. And the trailers look great. I'm hoping he really kind of hits a home run with this one because he's kind of had a rough track record as of late. And so I'm extremely excited.
Yeah, me too. Like you, Unbreakable, maybe my favorite M. Night Shyamalan and possibly where he is. His directorial efforts kind of took a nosedive after that. But yeah, not that I didn't want to watch Split, but I really wasn't, it wasn't on my radar as far as something I was going to go watch for sure. Until I had read after the fact that he snuck in that last 5 or 6 minutes that ties it into Unbreakable. And it's actually a really good movie. So I'm very, very excited for Glass.
Oh, so you hadn't seen Split until you found out they were tying them all together?
No, I had heard that it was actually quite excellent in its own right, but I had not seen it or really had planned to go see it or see it, stream it, until I heard it was part of the Unbreakable
universe. I'm gonna have to go see Split because I'm sure we'll have to... We're going to have to talk about Glass in January, so I'm going to have to find time to see Split, by God.
Yeah, and I want to rewatch Unbreakable.
Oh, I'll take any excuse to rewatch Unbreakable.
It's so good. I mean, can you imagine if this is like a like M. Night Shyamalan's career just kind of goes back up on the upward track? I mean, it would be crazy.
Oh, it'd be nice. I mean, the stuff of his that's good is very good. It's just, sometimes he gets in his own way, and I really think he should not act in his own movies anymore, especially making himself like a key component and a main character. I mean, if you want to do cameos, if you want to pull the Hitchcock, go for it, but he's not, he's definitely not on the level of somebody that should be, a major plot point hinging on his appearance in the film at all.
Totally agree. All right, and that'll do it for this episode segment of In the Pipeline. And that will bring us to our main event this episode, Ant-Man, specifically Ant-Man and the Wasp, but also the original Ant-Man in the MCU.
So, how long have you been Ant-Man again?
Not long. It just sort of happened.
I wish I could fight bad guys like you.
I seem to mess it up almost every time.
Maybe you just need someone watching your back. Like a partner.
And that brings us to our main event today, Ant-Man and the Wasp. The most recent installment of the MCU Marvel Cinematic Universe. Certainly won't be the last installment, but a fitting episode to do today, seeing as Mr. Stan Lee passed away recently. And of course, along with many other characters, this is the one of the ones that he came up with.
Yeah, it's nice that I think it you know, made perfect sense for us to take a look at this one. And like I said, it's the most recent MCU movie, and you know, you've got, I think, what is it, Captain Marvel coming out next, followed by the follow-up to Avengers Infinity War. Hopefully we'll find out the name of that sequel and trailer at some point soon. People keep saying it's going to come out in early December, which is in a few weeks, but you know, until then, this is our
last glimpse at the MCU.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting because when I first read about them doing Ant-Man and, you know, going into Guardians of the Galaxy, I really thought that they were kind of dipping into their, you know, C-level characters. That, like, I had sort of heard of the Guardians. I'd never heard of Ant-Man before, and it just sounded so ridiculous. And like, I somehow they pulled it off. Like, somehow they managed to make these movies hilarious, but also still action-packed, still have a little bit of, you know, drama. You know, the effects are still amazing, and it's still, you know, they're all successful. And they and this one was nice because this one kind of answered, you know, this big question I had, at least in the most recent Avengers movie, which was, you know, where the hell was Paul Rudd? You know, where was Lang? Where was all the Van Dynes? Like, where was everybody during
all the other superheroes?
Yeah, and they did such a great job explaining it, while also, you know, like, this movie kind of in the timeline runs parallel to this last Avengers movie, and, you know, culminates in that last mid-credit scene, you know, showing that it just ties right into the Avengers. And obviously Ant-Man's going to show up in the next Avengers movie, and apparently it's going to have a lot to do with the Quantum Realm. And so it's, you know, I think it made perfect sense for this to be the movie that tied in. You know, as you know, I mean, they're just so smart about the order they're releasing these movies and the way they're putting them together. It's just, you know, it's fantastic the way they do this. It's very smart.
Yeah. It's even though it's, you know, the Ant-Man movies are not the biggest part of the MCU up until this point, it's still this most recent one with the Wasp. It fills a very huge plot hole, and, you know, progressing through the storyline that will, you know, will take us to Infinity War or Avengers 4, I'm sorry.
whatever they're going to call it.
Avengers Infinity something. But yeah, Avengers 4. But like you, I was very skeptical when they wanted to start doing Ant-Man movies because, I mean, I know the character from the comic books. I think actually he's actually an original Avenger. Like, he was one of the founding members of the that superhero group. But just the idea of, you know, even the name Ant-Man is not really, really as cool as Spider-Man.
It does sound kind of ridiculous. Like, hey, we're done with all of our main superheroes. Let's do Ant-Man.
So he shrinks to the size of ants and enslaves them, actually, if you think about it.
Enslave
to make
the
them
ants.
Do his bidding.
Sure, that's perfectly reasonable. Let's make a big budget movie about it.
Yeah. I mean, even at that point, there was really no wrong that Marvel could do and Kevin Feige. But even the casting of Paul Rudd, like, I was totally, that would not have been on my radar at all. And he does an excellent job.
Oh, yeah. I think he's fantastic. It's, you know, and plus, I think because the original Ant-Man was Hank Pym, which is Michael Douglas's character. Am I correct? Is that?
Yes, it's correct.
And at first, the way I thought they were going to do it was, like, you know, Michael Douglas was going to be in the first 5 minutes. He was going to have Lang show up, you know, Paul Rudd's character, and take over, and then he was going to be done. But he's, you know, he's an integral part of the first movie and the second film. Like, he is, you know, main character throughout. And so they managed to kind of work in the original Ant-Man while passing the torch on this younger one. And, you know, Paul Rudd, like you said, I was surprised at the casting. I mean, it kind of made sense when Edgar Wright was first writing and directing it, when they first started developing it years and years ago. And then when, you know, Edgar Wright left the project, you know, they still held on to Paul Rudd. And so it was like, well, what are they going to do with it now? You know, Edgar Wright is much more comedic than anything they'd come up with. But then you know, what they ended up doing with it, it's just, it was, I thought it was the perfect balance of, you know, comedy and action. And I thought they did a fantastic job with that first one.
Totally. Surprised me actually how much I really liked the original one. And they just continued it with, you know, Peyton Reed came back, you know, I guess finished the first one and then directed Totally.
That's right. He did the second one. And, oh, I think writer wise, I think they had an entirely new writer staff, except for Paul Rudd being credited as a writer. Everybody else was a new writer staff, but it still felt like the same. You know, it was a very cohesive sequel, and it still felt like it was part of the same universe. It didn't feel disjointed, and it felt much bigger, and it felt, you know, it still felt funnier. And then you've got, you know, Evangeline Lilly taking, you know, a big lead in the spot as the Wasp, which I thought they did a very good job balancing both both superheroes. And I thought the villains that they had this time around with the ghost, I thought there was a lot of layers to, you know, to the fact that, you know, some of their main villains were, you know, she was, a lot of what the ghost was doing, for example, was because, you know, she was, you know, trapped in this flux and was dying, and she was just kind of doing it because she had to. And then, you know, Lawrence Fishburne helping her out because, you know, he was pissed off at Michael Douglas's character. And it was just, there was just a lot of layers to it that I thought they did a very good job balancing in this new movie, for sure.
Yeah. And it's always interesting that, with every MCU movie that comes out, we're still getting smaller, or actually bigger, glimpses of what has happened in the past, you know, before even Iron Man and everything started, this whole train, with S.H.I.E.L.D. and everything like that. So, you know, Michael Douglas, Hank Pym started S.H.I.E.L.D. Like you said, Lawrence Fishburne's character used to work at S.H.I.E.L.D. Ghost, apparently, S.H.I.E.L.D. for some reason turned her into, you know, the weapon that she turned out to be. All these little things that connect, and it's just amazing with, what, 20 movies deep into this universe that everything goes, fits so well. Under the same umbrella.
Casting is always spot on. Like, there's never really any duds in any of these roles. Like, everybody, I mean, even down to like supporting parts, like, you know, the fact that they brought all of Paul Rudd's, you know, friends back, you know, Michael Pena and everybody, like, they're just, you know, everything just works so well together, and they do such a good job with it that it's like, you know, you keep waiting. It's like, oh, well, you know, they had a good run, but after this, they can't possibly sustain it. And they always, you know, just keeps getting better. I mean, Black Panther comes out, and that movie's amazing, and it's getting awards. It's all, you know, all this stuff. It's just, it's incredible what they can do. And, you know, the creative people they have behind the scenes, it's just, you know, what can't they do at this point?
Oh, pretty bulletproof. I'm glad you mentioned Michael Pena. He's, one of my favorite points of both the Ant-Man and the sequel, Ant-Man and the Wasp. I mean, the scenes where he's retelling past events, and it's just hilarious. He's total scene stealer.
Oh, his versions of like everything going through his filter is just ridiculous. It's so funny. And then in the second one, you know, they've got him, they've still got him doing his shtick, but, like, you know, he's a big part of, you know, the action set pieces and stuff. And so it's just, you know, they do such a good job balancing the comedy and the action. And they're just so much fun to watch. That it's just like, you know, I think at this point, the only Marvel movies I haven't seen, I've not seen Doctor Strange. I have not seen the last Thor movie, the Ragnarok.
Okay.
I think those might be the only two that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah. I've seen them all. I think a lot of, critics and audiences liked Ragnarok a little bit more than I did. I still enjoyed it, but it was a little bit too much comedy on that for me. I think the Ant-Man and the Ant-Man and the Wasp movies kind of fit that role in the MCU a little bit better than the character of Thor. But like you said, everything works almost seamlessly from movie to movie, director to director. It's all under the, you know, supervision of Kevin Feige, who's, you know, apparently a genius when it comes to all this stuff.
And somehow he keeps it all moving together. I mean, I'm sure there's other people behind the scenes, but for him to be kind of the figurehead that, you know, keeps everything tied together, it's just... And like, you know, like you said too, with Thor, like, I'd heard a lot of people with the same criticism with the comedy, and it's tough because, You know, if you've got a film like The Avengers and Thor says one funny line and people are like, oh, I loved it how Thor was funny. You know, part of why people like that is because it's kind of out of character and because it's unique. But sometimes the creative forces see that and they're like, well, maybe we need an entire comedy based on Thor. And it's, you know, like you saw, you know, you brought up a good point that the, you know, the Ant-Man movies and the Guardians movie really do a good job filling that void of, you know, like just straight up comedy that also happens to be like balls to the wall action movies that are, you know, full of these amazing effects and that tie into the larger universe. You know, maybe we don't necessarily need an entire movie of funny Thor.
Well, part of that also is, you know, the Chris Hemsworth in other movies that he's done, Ghostbusters, for example, he's excellent. I mean, he's funny. He can do it all. So, I mean, you know, props to him. And Thor Ragnarok is fun, but it seems to take me out of place for a Thor movie to have so much almost slapstick comedy in it. But
that's, oh, really? I didn't realize it was went that route.
That's my feeling. Not that it was bad in any stretch of imagination, but and they all shouldn't be. Don't get me wrong; they all shouldn't be like serious. And I know some people don't even like the little bits of, you know, comedy that they have in, you know, Avengers movies and whatnot. But certainly better than basically being straight up dark like Batman versus Superman.
I still haven't seen that one. I saw Justice League, and I still haven't gotten around to seeing. Just because it just looks so miserable. Like, I mean, I don't know, that sort of thing has its place, but it's like, you know, it's the same thing we're talking about character wise. Like, that's not what I'm looking for Superman. Like, I'm really glad that worked with Batman, but it's just not necessary. Like, if I go to see a Superman movie, I don't need to see him brooding for 2 hours, you know, which is, you know, which is one of the things about, you know, coming back to Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's like you really get everything you're looking for in this movie. Like, you have these big action set pieces, you know, the movie is just like moving forward at such a fast pace and there's so many cool things happening and it's so well done. And then you have these really great random comedy moments with, you know, Randall Park being was it the FBI agent? He had to come keep checking on him. And it was just, he's just like, there's just these little 2-minute scenes where like he's desperate to catch him. He's so desperate to catch Paul Rudd in some kind of, you know, lie, or that he's escaping his house or whatever. And, you know, Rudd's got this whole, he's got the ankle monitor on the damn ants, and he's got the ants playing video games and stuff. It just, I mean, just these random little bits that pop in there are just, they seem like they'd be out of place, but they do such a good job of blending the two of those together that it's such a fun movie. And, you know, I mean, whatever happens after the Avengers movie, I would love to see another Ant-Man movie after this.
Totally. And another good point about Randall Park and, you know, going in line with all the other supporting characters. I mean, that's just that little, I mean, he's really good in this, that little scene where he's the first time they storm in and then he's saying, Scott Lang is trying to explain how he's supposed to keep his daughter entertained when he's, you know, under house arrest for 2 years. I had to learn this. And he does the little, you know, sleight of hand trick with him.
Oh, yeah.
And after all that, right. Randall Park's character, I can't remember his name, the FBI agent. It's like, how did you do it, Scott? It's like so serious. Like, you know, how did you escape and help the Avengers? No. The car trick. It's just like a great reaction. And another thing about this, and with every, not just Avengers movies, but movies in general, the de-aging, like when you see in the past, Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer and Lawrence Fishburne, and I think in one or two scenes, it's crazy.
Oh, I can't believe they're able to do what they do. And I mean, you know, sometimes you'll see stills of it, like when you've seen stills of like young Nick Fury coming up in Captain Marvel. It's, you know, stills are easy enough to do, but to actually have, you know, like film and high def film and like 4K, like, so where you can see all the flaws and everything. And like, you look up and it's like they just took footage of Michael Douglas from, you know, 1984. I don't know how the hell they do it, but it's incredible.
It's absolutely amazing. Although I did read something about the effects companies that did it that said the easiest for them on this movie was Michelle Pfeiffer because she's aged so well.
Okay, I know that's actually a good point. Like, you know, she's got gray hair, but really, she doesn't look a ton older than her older films. You know, like, I mean, even going back to like Batman Returns and stuff, it's just like, you know, still looks amazing, has aged well. It makes her job a lot easier for sure.
I think they used Lawrence Fishburne's son as like a body double, and they kind of did work like that. And, you know, fortunately for them, all three of them, Douglas Pfeiffer and Fishburne, have a, you know, large catalog of movies going back to the time that they're de-aging them too, that they can have reference points.
Oh, that's a good point. Even think about that. That makes sense.
But yeah, eventually we won't need actors anymore.
Now it's just, I mean, they, you know, it's, and it's one of those things too, where like, even if you look at, what the hell was it? Rogue One, where you see Princess Leia at the end of it. Now, like, I feel like the Princess Leia scene worked really well because it was like 5 seconds long, whereas like the General Tarkin scenes were a little rougher because he was just up there constantly and he's constantly talking and he's walking around for like minutes on end, and it's, you have more time to kind of watch it and see the flaws and whatever. But like, you know, you watch these movies and, you know, I certainly believe they went back and they shot that stuff with Michael Douglas years and years ago and just stuck in the vault until they were able to make this movie. It's incredible. Yeah.
Do you remember when the Matrix sequels were coming out and they were talking about, you know, all the fully CGI characters, it was going to look so amazing? And
oh yeah, I thought that was, I you know, I guess they did a lot of that with Agent Smith, right?
Yeah, and also with like when Neo is flying around and stuff like that. So, you know, it doesn't, I mean, looking back on it, it doesn't look really great, but I think that's where kind of it all started. Fully CG actual actors, not, you know, animated characters. But one thing I did want to mention, on second viewing of this Ant-Man and the Wasp, do you remember the Scott Lang's ex, you know, the mother of his child, Judy Greer's character? So this is our first two episodes, we got Judy Greer movies going on.
I didn't even think about that. Weird.
Gotta find out what else she's doing for our next episode.
I realize their podcasts all tie Judy Greer into every one of their shows. I think we should just find a way to bring her up no matter what we're talking about. We'll be talking about like Mary Poppins next week. We're like, you know, Judy Greer once said. And actually, you know, talk about actresses. I mean, this is, you know, we didn't really talk about this. And, you know, this is deep dive kind of stuff that you can talk about for ages on end. But I believe that Ant-Man and the Wasp, I think this is the first like female-led, like female in the title Marvel Comics universe character, because, you know, she managed to beat Black Widow to the punch. And so I thought that I really wasn't sure if they were going to be able to balance out having, you know, two lead characters, you know, regardless of whether it was a man or woman, like just having the two leads like that, because Scott Lang is such a strong character and because he's so funny and so charismatic. I really thought Evangeline Lilly did such a fantastic job in this movie, really just kind of being her own character and really helping to anchor the movie with Paul Rudd. Like, I, you know, and it wasn't even anything, you know, I wasn't even worried about her as an actor or, you know, her being, you know, a woman or anything like that. It was really just a matter of like, you know, some of these movies just get so top heavy when they start adding too many elements like that. And so when you have two characters that are both really strong, I was worried that they wouldn't be able to actually balance it out to the point that they did. And it was just, you know, I thought they both did an amazing job working together. And even in the scenes where they were fighting together, it was just so fluid and it just made so much sense. It just made it even more fun to watch having the two of them together.
Oh, you're totally right. It worked really well. And honestly, after certainly Infinity War, all my doubts about having so many major characters in one movie totally unfounded. I'm willing to trust the MCU going forward with anything they want to do.
You know, that is a good point. I mean, like, you know, years ago they would talk about, like, you know, even like in Batman movies, like, oh, they had, like in Batman Returns, it was like, well, they had, you know, Penguin, but they also had Max Schreck and they had Catwoman. And like, people were like, it's, or in the Spider-Man movies too, they talk about Sandman and Venom and Green Goblin. And it's just, you know, they didn't really find a way to balance it. Whereas, like you said, somehow with, I mean, what, like 15, 16, 17 main characters, you know, even though everybody doesn't get the exact amount of screen time, I remember when Avengers first came out, they had like, you know, little charts of like who was in the movie for how long. And even Robert Downey Jr., who's, you know, you feel him throughout the entire movie, you feel his presence and he's important and he's, you know, charismatic. You know, you look at it and he was only in the movie for like 25 minutes or something. And he was like the most. And then you had like Thor was in it for 18 minutes. But somehow they work it just the right way, where the way they have the characters working together, it just it doesn't feel like, you know, you're really wanting more from anybody. I mean I'm sure they after how big Black Panther was, I'm sure they wished Black Panther had been in it a little bit more.
I'm sure the decision to have him vanish after the snap was before Black Panther blew up.
Whoops.
But yeah, and also they benefit from the fact that we've seen the majority of these characters previously, so, you know, we're not worried about backstory or, you know, telling the audience who these people are. You know, generally they will know already, which is, you know, what the DC movies have mostly failed at. I personally could sit through a 3-hour movie if it's done right, because I love these characters, you know, from reading comics and stuff like that. But I don't think it would actually work for a proper movie.
That's a good point. I mean, even Infinity War was pretty epic, but it didn't feel like it was. Like, you were never sitting there going, oh, how many hours is this movie? Like, it flew by because it was so well done.
Can you imagine the next one's got to be... I'm sure they're not final, but their first cut is probably close to 4.5 hours.
It's tough because so many of the stuff I watch on streaming nowadays, I don't have a chance to go through a lot of the extras. But I can only imagine like how many deleted scenes they had in this first or in this third Avengers movie, because it just, you know, there's just so much going on.
And one last thing about the Ant-Man movies, I think they, you know, obviously we've only had two, but they showcase how far Marvel has come through the whole MCU process. They used to get, and to some extent still get some criticism for how they handle villains in their movies. Like, early on, the villain is always kind of like the obvious opposite of the hero. And they also got killed off in the end, you know, which kind of prevents future storylines, I guess you could say, especially for big villains that they used to kill off. And I think in the first Ant-Man, Yellowjacket, played by Corey Stahl, kind of fell in. I enjoy the character a lot, but fell into a lot of those, you know, he's obviously, you know, a little insect in a shrinking suit, you know, the bad guy somehow jumps into the suit and can control it, even though the hero took the first hour of the movie to figure out how to control his powers. And then he dies, but in, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Ghost character, who was really quite cool, I think. I don't remember if this is a new character or someone from the comic books, but, you know, we get her backstory and she's, you know, equal to the heroes in the movie, but they don't just go kill her off at the end.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a lot more nuanced, and I think something like that is more interesting to watch because, you know, it does break that trope of, like, you know, good guy learns how to use his powers, runs into bad guy, they battle, bad guy dies, end of movie. And so there, you know, the fact that it's more complicated than her just being a bad guy out to destroy the world, I thought that they did, you know, a fantastic job making it different and making it work within within this film. And again, like you said, you know, she's around at the end, and so much like, you know, Dark Knight, you know, before Heath Ledger passed away, I mean, instead of killing the Joker off at the end, you know, you knew that even if he didn't show up in the third film, he was still out there, and there was still a possibility of him, you know, causing problems down the line or doing something different or, you know, adding something new to the universe. And so, you know, so it's like Loki. I mean, Loki keeps showing up, and imagine how much different these films would have been if they had just killed him at the end of the first Thor movie, like they had, you know, done in so many other movies. I mean, you would have lost so many good scenes between him and Thor. And then, you know, him showing up as something larger than the Avengers. And it's, I definitely agree with you on that.
Yeah, and I would think for, you know, directors and writers that they would at least give options, right? If you just kill off a character in the first, movie, then, you know, not saying that you should reuse villains very often, but in some cases, these comic book characters, their, you know, personality and the whole reason for who they are and how they go through their lives is very much impacted by certainly their biggest villains. But I just thought that the two Ant-Man movies, only two of them, but they show how far Marvel has come, and I very much look forward to early next year having three more Marvel movies to go to the theaters and see.
All right, that leads us into our final segment that we call Reboot Wish List. This is where we discuss any ideas for reboots or sequels that we're, you know, that aren't happening yet, but that maybe we think would be a good idea. Or, you know, if you out there in listener land have any ideas yourselves, you could always hit us up and let us know. Justin, any ideas for reboots or sequels you want to pitch?
Going with the, I was thinking about it a little bit, and last episode, I went, I think we both did, we went pretty old, what, 50s or 60s movies, I can't remember, something like that.
Yep, right, yep.
Maltese Falcon and the Sting. I'm going to stick with the 80s, which is what a lot of reboots and sequels, I guess, are poaching from, our beloved childhood in the 80s movies that we grew up. I'm gonna say let's see a reboot of Adventures in Babysitting.
Ah, I love that movie. Oh, very good.
And it's so good, and it just came to me that they had you know, quote unquote Thor in that movie, so that ties into lots of stuff that's happening now in the movies.
That's right. She was obsessed with Thor, and she thought the mechanic was Thor. Oh, I love that movie. I think that you're right. I think that there was so much about it that was unique to the time, but I think that updating it, they could do a lot of really cool things with it.
Yeah, it just seems like a nice, you know, it certainly has to a certain, you know, segment of population that, not cult, but, you know, nostalgic remembrance of what was that, when they come out in 86, 87, something like that?
Somewhere,
yeah, and Elizabeth Shue. I mean, you know, who didn't have a crush on Elizabeth Shue in the mid-80s?
I did.
Yes. So I think a young up-and-coming actress, you know, with the good writing, maybe not exactly the same plot, obviously, but I think they could update that quite well. And, you know, 30 years down the line, I think it's that would make for a good reboot.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. I support that wholeheartedly.
Thank you, sir. What about you? You come up with anything this week?
Well, I was thinking recently through Halloween, I saw the new version of Stephen King's It, which I assume maybe we'll talk about next year when they come out with It Chapter 2. And I thought they did a really good job taking a movie that was originally on ABC and they couldn't really do much with the gore, and going back and kind of revisiting the source material and doing something different with it. And I think that I would love to see something similar done with another one of Stephen King's epic massive novels, The Stand, which was produced again, I think, on ABC as a miniseries, and I, you know, enjoyed it for what it was. But the opportunity to do that in like an R-rated format and with updated effects, and, you know, maybe, you know, somewhat different plotting based on going back to the novel and kind of digging through there and seeing what's relevant in today's society, that sort of thing, you know, especially with people worrying about like super bugs and stuff like that, and the end times, you know, keeping things nice and light. I think that, you know, there's a lot of really good actors out there that could fill the roles that they had in the original, and I think they could do a lot of really cool things with it after having seen what they did. I mean, I didn't have high hopes for a new version of It when I watched it, and I thought it was fantastic, and I can't wait for the second one. So I think it'd be a really cool idea to take something like The Stand that had the same limitations with special effects and budget and cable, your network television channel, you can't do as much as you could with gore, just to be able to update it and push the envelope a little bit more. I think that's I think I'd like to see that.
I think that's an excellent choice. I'm totally on board for pretty much anything Stephen King getting put on film, so
nice.
Totally with you right there. That will do it for this episode of Movies Never Say Die. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, we'd love to hear from you. Any suggestions for movie reboots for the Reboot Wishlist segment? Let us know. You can email us at moviesneversaydie@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, @moviesneversaydie, and, of course, on Twitter, at Movies Never Say Die. And as always, you can find us on Apple Podcasts or Google Play. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing. And that'll be it. Until next time, I'm Justin St. Ange.
I'm Matthew Grant. Thanks for downloading.
I'm Batman.
I freeze. I'm Batman.
I'm Batman.
I'm Batman-ing.
I never had to say I'm Batman. I showed up. People knew I was Batman.
You like movies?
Hundreds of movies.
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 Never say die!